Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting faith with life.
Hi, welcome once again to Connecting Faith. I always appreciate the opportunity to be together with you and talk about important issues and get great insights. And we have wonderful guests to interact with, and today is no exception. So I invite you to just stay tuned. And actually, if you're at a spot where maybe you have a Bible or New Testament, you could get out or look something up on your device. You could maybe follow along and just gain some insight, because we're going to talk today about the Gospel of John, and particularly as it's reflected on in Michael Card's latest work from the Biblical Imagination series, John, the Gospel of Wisdom. And if you have been listening to Connecting Faith for any length of time, you know that we've talked with Michael over the course of at least the four Gospels. This is the final book in this series, and we're happy to welcome Michael back to the broadcast. Michael, good to have you on today.
Hey, Neil. Thanks. That is great to be back.
So, as you know, Michael Card's got a career spans 30-plus years, recorded over 31 albums, authored or co-authored over 24 books, and done a radio program, and has written several books. And this, of course, is part of the series that actually has some music along with it, and we may touch on that in a bit as well. But I was thinking, and it's from InterVarsity Press, by the way, and I should mention I've got a couple copies to give away, and we'll do that via email today, and more on that coming up. But so John, the Gospel of Wisdom, it's the final book in the Biblical Imagination series. And Michael, I want to start out with the question, what's the difference between imagination and speculation? Because speculation doesn't seem like it's necessarily a good idea when it comes to Scripture.
Well, I think people sometimes speculate with their imaginations, but we talk about the informed imagination. What I mean by that is before we engage with Scripture at the level of our imagination, we do our homework. We find out, you know, what was the life situation in John, you know, John's community? Who is John? Who are the Pharisees? Who are the Sadducees? That sort of thing. And then once you have some information, then I think it's legitimate to engage with your imagination. And then I can imagine, you know, what is it like for Jesus to confront, you know, this fairly severe back to the Bible group called the Pharisees? Or, you know, what is it like for him to stand up in the middle of a festival like Tabernacles, like he does in chapter 7, stand up in the middle of a crowd in which there are people that have already made a vow to kill him? What's it like for him to stand up and shout, "If a man's thirsty, let him come to me and drink"? So I think that's the difference. We're not speculating with our imaginations. We're engaging with the text.
Well, in fact, I know you use that very illustration of John 7 kind of to begin this book and talk about how it kind of all began for you. You've been a Bible student for many years, but you've learned a lot from your mentor. Maybe just tell us a bit more about how that story kind of opened it up for you.
Sure. I went to Western Kentucky University, this in Bowling Green, Kentucky, in about 1976, 77. As a wildlife management major. My dream was to do bird counts for the Forestry Service, and I still think that'd be a pretty cool job.
Yeah.
But
guess I should just as a side note, you've been doing any of that in your backyard at all? Or
no,
not?
I don't have time. All I do is work. I'm like you. All I do is work.
Okay.
But we had to take a humanities class, and I was a Christian. In fact, I was a part of the Jesus movement. I was already kind of a Bible geek back in those days, and I took a class with a wonderful professor named William Lane, and I had been taught to be leery of Bible professors. I was from a more conservative background, and we were taught, you know, these guys will pick apart your faith and leave you, you know, to yourself to put it back again, together again. And instead, what I encountered was a very pastoral, very loving man who was at the same time, I mean, absolutely brilliant, a Harvard PhD. He spoke 16 languages, taught the Bible from memory, which is a pretty stunning thing.
Yeah.
And I remember the day in class, I basically, in fact, I talk about it in the John book. He was sharing about John 7 and all this Hebrew background from the Talmud and from the Mishnah. And I said, okay, that's it. Yeah. I want to be that guy.
Because just by giving you background, for example, I mean, I guess I didn't realize that too, that this was when Jesus said those words, "If you're thirsty," I mean, it was in the middle of a of a celebration feast where they actually poured water on the ground, right?
That was... Right. Part of the commemoration. And Jesus does this a lot, actually. He's not speaking in isolation. A lot of times he's in an area where he's pointing to things, or he's making a reference to people that are around him. And if you don't understand who the crowd is, sometimes you'll miss it. But in 7, John lets us know in verse 1 that it's tabernacles. But I think it's not until verse 37 that John says, on the last and greatest day of the feast. And if you go to your Mishnah and look in the section on Sukkot, it's called in the Mishnah, that's their word for tabernacles. You find out that on the last and greatest day of the feast, the high priest pours out a pitcher of water and quotes a passage from the prophets, which says, with joy you will draw water from the wells of salvation. And so it's precisely at that time. You know, John doesn't give us that background for nothing, right? Yeah. On the last and greatest day of the feast, what happens? Jesus stands up in the middle of this large crowd and says, if a man is thirsty, let him come to me and drink. And if you put the two and two together, I mean, the high priest, you know, shouts above the crowd, you know, with joy you will draw water from the wells of salvation. And Jesus says, if a man's thirsty, let him come to me and drink. That it was that passage, those that background and that passage put together that changed my life. Mm.
And I think it does for all of us when we hear a pastor, you know, maybe expounding on a passage, or we, you know, read it through a commentary like yours, or you know, some, we never read it the same again, do we?
Right. That's just it. And so we are in debt, you know, to the men and women who have done that homework for us. And again, I think it's fun to do the homework yourself, yeah. But because, you know, there, depending on what area you're in, there's not always that much literature that you have to become familiar with. But we do have people like, we have the D.A. Carsons and the William Lanes and the Craig Keeners and the George Guthries. I mean, all these wonderful scholars who've done that work for us. And so I'm not saying that we stop reading scriptures and just read commentaries, but if you read the better commentaries can make a huge difference.
Do you define these books on the Gospels? Do you consider them commentaries, or how would you actually, you know, explain them to someone? And say, well, you know, what are these about? Obviously, they're about the Gospels, and this one, the Gospel of John. But
yeah, I mean, at the most, I would call them devotional commentaries. It ill behooves me to call it a commentary when if you've spent time with, like I have, with people like Bill Lane, who really wrote commentaries. I mean, he took him 11 years to write his Mark commentary. That's, I think commentary kind of implies a more exhaustive piece of work. And for me, I mean, I was exhausted when I was finished. but my books are more devotional. And I hope, because I have pretty good bibliographies in all of them, I hope that they'll lead people to say, you know, wow, let me dig a little deeper. Let me get a copy of the Mishnah. You know, they're not that hard to find.
Yeah, we're talking today with Michael Carter about the latest Gospel Review that he's done, part of the Biblical Imagination series, and the final Gospel that he's released now. It's just out from InterVarsity Press. John, the Gospel of Wisdom, and talk about, you know, John giving us background. Give us some background about John, kind of, I mean, who he was writing for, and this was the final gospel, so that has some significance too, doesn't it?
Well, I think it does. If you consider that John at this point is an elderly man, there's a rumor, we find out in chapter 21, that the rumor has started that he's not going to die until Jesus came back, which of course is a false rumor. We know that he's given leadership over a circuit of churches in Asia, in the Roman province of Asia, not Asia as we know it. And we see the list of those churches in Revelation, the letters, the seven letters. We know that he's living in Ephesus, and that in of itself is a huge, huge fact. Ephesus was, I call it, it's a sister city of Jerusalem. It's a temple city. The whole economy is based on the temple. So those are very much the same. One is a pagan temple and one's a Jewish temple, but they had both become what Jesus would call, marketplaces. Jesus is not so thrilled that the Jerusalem temple is all about money either. Mm-hmm. So I think when you read the Gospel of John, you have to realize it's not like Mark. Mark is writing down you know, it's only been 30 years or less since Jesus has died that Mark writes his gospel. And he's writing down Peter's testimony. So Mark is really the gospel of Peter. But then, you know, 60, well, let's say 40, 30, 40 years later, everyone's dead. Paul, Peter have been dead for 30, 40 years. John's the last living disciple. When you read the Gospel of John, you're sitting at the feet of the last living disciple of Jesus, and you're hearing information that he has taught and preached for all those decades. And I think it's fairly simple to see that's the difference. I mean, we read John and there's all this beautiful themes, and you know, the language is very high Christology and that sort of thing. I think that points to the fact that this is a man who's dealt with this material for decades.
And we can benefit from his careful study and living it out, and we're going to find out more as we continue to unpack more about the Gospel of John. John, the Gospel of Wisdom is the subtitle of Michael's new devotional commentary. It's from the Biblical Imagination series, and we're talking with Michael Card today, who's an award-winning musician and performing artist and has written these wonderful insights and drawn from information from other scholars, and we're just grateful for it. And we've got some copies to give away, by the way. If you want to sign up for one, why not go to our website at myfaithradio.com, click on the Connecting Faith show page, and there's an email link there, and it just sends your contact information, and we'll do a drawing for that here at the end of the program. And we'll continue with Michael in just a moment here on Connecting Faith.
Feet, which is only in John. There are no parables. I mean, how can you tell the story of the life of Jesus? I think Matthew says he never taught anything except he'd use a parable. And yet in John, there are no parables of Jesus. But what he does, he teaches, he presents the life of Jesus as a parable. Jesus will say, "I'm the bread of life," and he'll feed 5,000 people. He'll say, "I'm the light of the world." He'll open the eyes of a man born blind. It's all developed that way, and again, that's a very high, the theologians call it a high Christology. It's a very high point of view at looking at the life of Jesus.
Would it be because John would have known that these other accounts are out there, or that, as you said, he's been preaching and teaching this, so that there a lot of this was known and assumed, so he just didn't want to, I don't know, reasons why it's so uniquely different?
Well, the truth is we don't know for sure if he's got the synoptics or one or more of the synoptics. I like to think that he did. I mean, they're letters or documents that have been circulated all through the churches. I think it's just as simple as that. I think John has in his possession one or more of the synoptics. If not that, then he knows this block of material, this tradition that's being taught on the life of Jesus. But again, when you see, no birth narratives, right? Matthew and Luke have birth narratives. John doesn't have, no stars, no shepherds, no wise men. But what does he substitute? He gives us the incarnation, which no one else, talks about in that way. And you can go on and on and on about the uniquenesses of John. One of the most interesting things to me is John. He does these, I call it whispering. He whispers to us. He speaks in these little asides, and there's about 50 of them. The other Gospels do it too. I think Matthew does it twice. Mark does it once or twice. But John does it 56 some odd times. And by this, I mean, you know, something will happen, and then John will sort of whisper over his shoulder, you know, Jesus already had in mind what he was going to do when he said this. Or, you know, Jesus' brothers said this not because they believed in him, but, you know, he's always explaining things to us. And for me, as a reader, that makes him so much more present. I really am sitting at the feet of this little old man who's explaining things that he knows from telling these stories so many times, that there are certain gaps that he needs to fill in. And he's always doing that. That's one of the things I love about John.
Even as I was reading your reflections on it, I hadn't thought about it in terms of, I mean, you talk about it as John sort of having preached this material for years. I mean, you can almost read it like sermons, that there's, you know, there's great theology all the way through.
In fact, there are in the first three chapters, there are little blocks of sermons. Sometimes, unfortunately, in red-letter Bibles, these are put in red letters. But John 3:16, that whole passage, that's not Jesus speaking. That's John preaching. And you learn to hear the tone of his preaching when you listen to the introduction, that the whole, you know, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. That's John preaching. And he tends to bring up themes in these little sermons, and then there'll be a block of narratives, say on John the Baptist or someone like that, and then he'll go back to preaching and he'll pick up all the other blocks that he's going to introduce, and then there'll be Nicodemus, or in fact, one of the other differences of John is that he takes several characters and spends sometimes a whole chapter. The man who was born blind, he spends a whole chapter telling the story of one man. Now, the other Gospels don't do that, but the woman at the well, the woman taken in adultery, Nicodemus, the man who was lame 38 years, the man who was born blind, there's all these characters. And I honestly think, Neil, it's a function of him being old. I mean, I'm rapidly becoming a little old man, and when I tell stories about my life, I tell them in terms of people. So if you were to say, you know, tell me about your life, I'd say, well, there was this man, William Lane, and he made a big impact on me. And then there's this other guy, Denny Denson, and I would tell you the story of all these people. And I hope I'm not reading too much into it, but I really think that's, after a while, certainly if you're 90, 80 or 90 years old, that's how you tell the story of your life.
It does make it, you know, interesting reading. I mean, and particularly if you are trying to maybe memorize or familiarize yourself with, I mean, you know, John chapter 3, it's Nicodemus. John chapter 4, it's the woman at the well.
Right.
There's, you know, John chapter 9, the man born blind. I mean, you can sort of, you know, find your markers along the way.
Absolutely. Right? And the synoptics, you don't do that.
Yeah.
You know, you'll have at most, you know, maybe the centurion, you know, you'll have eight or 10 verses, you know, in Luke on the centurion whose slave is sick, or I'm sure there's some other examples, but never will you have a whole chapter talking about one person, and, you know, they meet Jesus and this happens, and then their parents do this, and then the high priest does this. And I think especially the man who was born blind, he's this dear, dear person who in the course of a chapter in the Gospel of John goes from not knowing who Jesus is at all to the point where he's falling at his feet and calling him Lord.
Yeah, one of the best chapters in all the Bible, certainly of the Gospel there.
And it's funny, you know, the high priest push him and he says, oh, you know, why do you keep asking me? Do you want to believe in him too? And every time I'll do that at a Bible study, everyone laughs.
Yeah.
And I'll say, you know what? John knew that was funny when he wrote that down. People have been laughing at that story for 2,000 years.
Yeah. Does that mean we, somehow I think we assume that, well, the gospel accounts are, it's from, you know, from birth to death in essence, that it's a chronological account. But this John seems much more not that way, right?
Well, there are people who like to fight and say they've got to be strictly chronological. Nowhere do the Gospels claim that they're chronological. There's one reference to an orderly account, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's chronological. Mm. I tend to believe that they are chronological, simply because there's no real reason for them not to be. Some of the examples, like John is a classic example. People will say, well, you know, one of the first things that Jesus does in John is tear up the temple. And we all know, you know, from the synoptics that that happens at the end of the ministry. Well, I say no. I really think it happened twice. And those are two completely different incidences. And to me, it helps me understand the context of Jesus' whole ministry. He opens and closes his ministry by tearing up the temple, which was a very, you know, risky thing to do. The other one is chapter 21. You have the miraculous catch of fish, and people read that and say, "Well, that's Luke 5." We all know that happened early in the ministry. I say, "No, it happened twice." Yeah. And I think it's important to realize in that case that actually happened twice, because John recognizes it's Jesus in chapter 21 because Jesus had done this before. John doesn't recognize Jesus. He looks at the fish and sees a miraculous catch and goes, "Oh man, it's the Lord."
Which is an interesting, you know, by the time you get to John 21, you go, really, you know, how wouldn't he have known by then? That's kind of one of those puzzled things, I guess.
Yeah. But
it does remind us, though, and maybe before we take a break, just to say a word about the fact that these are testimony accounts. We, you know, sometimes we expect the Gospels to be, you know, their documentaries or something. But
well, you know, I think my big frustration is I want a biography.
Yeah.
I mean, I want information, please. You know, what was his childhood like? What was it, you know, what was it like, you know, being around a perfect 10-year-old? But the Gospels are not biographies, and people who try to make them biographies do them a disservice. The Gospels are testimonies. That is, they are accounts of Jesus' life based on testimonies. And the first gospel, Mark, is the perfect example. That whole gospel is structured around two testimonies. The very first verse of Mark says, "The beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, part one, the Son of God, part two." The first section ends when Peter confesses Jesus is the Christ, and the second part ends when the Roman centurion confesses that Jesus is the Son of God. So, and I think all of the gospels take that pattern. Take up that pattern. So they are rotten biographies, but they are perfect. I mean, I'll take a bullet for that. They're absolutely perfect testimonies.
We're learning about more about John, the Gospel of Wisdom. It's from the Biblical Imagination series, the latest from musician, artist, and writer Michael Card. And we'll continue with more in a moment as we dig more into this wonderful gospel coming up here on Connecting Faith. You're listening to Connecting Faith, and we are spending some time today with Michael Card, working our way through the Gospel of John. He's written a new devotional commentary. It's the fourth in the series, the Biblical Imagination series, and been waiting for it, and know he's had the opportunity to spend a lot of time studying the Gospels, and we are benefiting from some of his insight. This called the Gospel of Wisdom, and let's pick up a little bit more on sort of the theme of misunderstanding, because that is kind of a main theme running through this Gospel.
Yeah, it really is. I think once you see this, if you haven't seen this before, it's stunning, really. And what happens in the Gospel of John is that every single time Jesus says something significant, something spiritual, he's always misunderstood. The woman at the well, you know, Jesus says, "I've got water, and you'll never be thirsty again." And she says, "What? Is it because you don't have a bucket that you're, you know, asking me for water?" And then Nicodemus, you know, that Nicodemus is one of the best examples. He said, "You know, you must be born again." And Nicodemus really can't grasp this. He says, "What? Can a man enter his mother's womb a second time to be born?" But every single time Jesus says something deep, it's always misunderstood, including the very last thing he says in John, which is this business. He's walking with Peter on the Sea of Galilee, and looks back at John, this young, I think John is probably only 14 or 15 years old when he's following him. And Peter says, well, what about him? And Jesus says, well, what's that to you? You follow me. You know, what if I wanted to remain alive until I return? What is that to you? You follow me. And the gospel goes on to say, you know, because of this, there was this misunderstanding. So, and I think in a lot of ways, it functions to cut Jesus off. He's more and more misunderstood. He's lonelier and lonelier until finally at the end on the cross, he's all alone. I think that's how John uses it, but I don't think he's making it up. I think John remembers that this was true of Jesus. The truth, you know, he talks about eating his flesh and drinking his blood in chapter 6, and people go crazy.
Yeah.
They simply cannot grasp this new reality over this old orthodoxy of Judaism. They just can't. They can't grasp it. In fact, John will say a lot of things they didn't understand until after the Spirit came.
Yeah. He in John we hear a lot of the I am statements. These talk a little bit about how Jesus reveals himself, maybe, or how we see him more clearly in John than the other synoptics.
Well, one of the things that's different about John is we have far fewer miracles. John is not interested in. Sometimes, like, you get the impression in Matthew that Matthew is sort of piling up miracles as evidence. But in John, the miracles all have to do with disclosure. The miracles point to who Jesus is. So Jesus will say, "I'm the life. I'm the resurrection. I'm the life." Then what does he do? He raises Lazarus. See, that's the miracle. And Jesus will say, "I'm the bread of life." And what does he do? The miracle. He feeds 5,000 people. He'll say, I'm the light of the world. And then there's this miracle. He opens the eyes of a man born blind. So the miracles in John have more to do with pointing to who Jesus is, which I think, again, I think it's a result of the fact that John has been preaching this material for all these decades. And he's put it together in perhaps a more sophisticated way than someone like Mark. Mark, who is just writing down Peter's testimony, Peter was probably in prison when he was doing it.
In fact, I hadn't really noticed it before, but just reading over it again, you know, the John 2 verse 23, I think it says, you know, Jesus in Jerusalem at the Passover feast. Many people saw the miraculous signs he was doing and believed in his name. I thought, well. But, you know, John doesn't really spend a lot of time talking about it, except at the end he said, you know, if we tried to write everything down, we wouldn't have room for it. So I guess that was the point, right?
Yeah, and that's sometimes you want to shake John for saying that. You know, I could have filled the whole world, you know, with or Jesus did many other things that aren't written in this book. And you go, please, tell me some more things. But I think, again, that's us wanting the Gospels to be biographies. And they're just not.
Yeah, and you do talk, I know, not only in this account but others too, about the sort of the unmiraculous miracles. That, and the wedding at Cana is sort of one of those good examples.
Yeah, and John, of course, that's only in John. Yeah. See, this first miracle of Jesus is only in John, and John, I think, gets this unmiraculous miracle business. And when I say unmiraculous miracles, I'm not saying Jesus' miracles aren't incredibly miraculous. They are, you know, amazing. You know, raising someone from the dead, not too shabby, right? Not too shabby. But what I'm saying is that when Jesus does his miracles, he does them in very subdued, unmiraculous ways. And because the point of a miracle is not, it's not proof. It's Jesus doesn't do miracles and say, now will you believe in me? See, I just raised this guy from the dead. In fact, what tends to happen in the Gospels, especially in a Gospel like Mark, is that Jesus demands that you believe before you see, because that's true faith. But the wedding at Cana is the perfect example. What happens? Jesus is there. We have this wonderful little glimpse of his relationship with Mary. You know, Mary does what my mom would do to me. She doesn't say straightforwardly, you know, will you fix this? Mary just says, they're out of wine, because she assumes he's going to do something, right? And then Jesus says this mysterious woman, which is a very, he's not being rude to his mother. I think it's a very, it's almost a term of endearment, almost my dear, you know, my time hasn't come yet. But then she immediately turns to the slaves and says, do whatever he tells you, because she knows he's going to do something, which I find that fascinating. And then what happens is this miracle that nobody sees. In fact, John will say only the slaves who drew the water even knew a miracle had happened. And yet, says John, this is how he shows his glory. He reveals his glory, and his disciples put their faith in him, not because there was a flash of light and hocus pocus and all this kind of stuff. That's not how Jesus does miracles. Sometimes he's not even there. Go home. Your servant's healed, you know. And I think the point is that's how he still does miracles. Jesus still does incredible miracles, but he does them in unmiraculous ways, in such a way that if you don't have faith, you don't even see that he's doing anything.
You mentioned, but you know, it's time and not yet come. That phrase shows up several times throughout the Gospels. Talk about that.
Well, and that first time is there at Cana. You know, my time hasn't come. And what happens is over and over, and I don't think the other Gospels do this, but over and over, Jesus is saying his time had not yet come. They try to arrest him. His time had not yet come. They try to seize him. His time had not yet come. Over and over and over again, that's said in John. And what it implies is, of course, that a time is coming. And the time comes, finally, when the Greeks come to Philip and they say, we'd like to see Jesus. And Jesus comes to Philip. Or I think Philip tells Andrew, and then Andrew and Philip together tell Jesus, you know, these Greeks are here. They want to see you. And it's at that moment that Jesus says, he doesn't even talk to the Greeks. I mean, he doesn't, you know, these Gentile believers who have come. Jesus says, the time has come. It's like that's the sign he's been waiting for. The fact that here this Gentile world is now kind of knocking on the door, and Jesus sees the coming of the Greeks as the sign that he's been waiting for 3 years, that now it's time for him to glorify the Father by dying.
God getting glory is a theme that runs throughout as well, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, Jesus is always, one of the things I find interesting in this unmiraculous miracle business is that Jesus never gets praised. I mean, at one time, I think in Matthew, he's worshiped after he calms a storm on the Sea of Galilee. But otherwise, what you see, and I still don't understand how he does it, he'll do a miracle and people praise God.
Yeah.
He always wins praise for the Father, and I don't know if it's his countenance or if it's his humility. Frequently in Mark, he'll say, don't tell anybody I did that, like he's keeping it a secret. So I find those kind of little details really interesting. I think it speaks of the humility of Jesus. I honestly think when Jesus tells someone, hey, it was your faith that healed you, I don't think that becomes a system for understanding how miracles work. You know, you'll hear people say, oh, Jesus couldn't heal anybody unless they had faith in him. Well, that's not true. He heals people who don't even know who he is.
Yeah.
You know, his lordship is absolute. I mean, Lord means Lord, so there's no constraints on him that he doesn't place, you know, on himself. So I really do think that's humility. I think his humility is key. I mean, Paul would say that in Philippians 2:6-11. His humility, his pointing away from himself, is a key to understanding who he is.
We'll talk more. We're going to review some of the characters that are recounted in John's Gospel account of the life of Jesus as we talk more with Michael Card. Michael, artist, musician, and author. He's written some. He's recorded 31 albums and 24 books, I guess more than that now. And the one we're talking about is the latest, called John, the Gospel of Wisdom. It's part 4 of the Biblical Imagination series. And Michael's with us today on Connecting Faith, and there's more coming up. More to come here with Michael Card as we spend a little time looking at the Gospel of John to help us understand who Jesus is more effectively. And Michael has written insightfully in this devotional commentary called John, the Gospel of Wisdom. It's the latest in the Biblical Imagination series. I encourage you to check it out from InterVarsity Press. In fact, there's music that accompanies it as well, which just adds to the great delight of understanding who Jesus is from these firsthand accounts more clearly. And let's talk about maybe just a few of the characters. I was interested in John chapter 5. That's at the man at the pool in Bethesda. And,
yes.
And he was a little bit of a whiner, you think.
Yeah, you know, I was teaching that someplace not long ago, and there was this press. I was up in Michigan, and I referred to the guy as a jerk. Now, that was probably a little too much, but there was this precious man who was so upset that I would refer to someone in the Bible as a jerk. So I won't call him a jerk, but he's not a very nice person, this man who's been lame for 38 years. And, but I think the upshot of the whole story is, because the first thing Jesus says is, do you want to get well? And at first you think, oh, how politically insensitive, how incorrect can you be, Jesus, to talk to a handicapped person like that? Which, of course, if you think Jesus is perfect, like I believe Jesus is, it was the perfect question, because the truth is he didn't want to be well. All he does in that whole long story, and this is one of those long personal stories that's only in John, all he does is make excuses. Oh, I can't, you know, there's always someone who gets down in front of me. So like in 38 years, you've been sitting there and you can't get it, you can't get in the front of the line. But what happens is Jesus heals him. And again, he doesn't know Jesus' name. That's one of the things I find fascinating. They see him carrying his mat, which he's not supposed to be doing because it's Sabbath. And they said, who healed you? And the guy says, I don't know. I mean, can you imagine someone healing you after 38 years of being lame and you don't even learn their name? And I think he's meant to be contrasted with the man who was blind from birth, who immediately learns Jesus' name, even though he's never seen him. They say, who did this to you? Oh, he knows his name. He says, Jesus of Nazareth.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the man who's lame for 38 years is not a person I think very highly of, because when he does find out who Jesus is, what does he do? Does he worship him? No, he runs and tells the Pharisees that it was Jesus who made him well, knowing that that's going to get Jesus in trouble. So, no, I don't like that guy very much.
And we won't read that account the same either after this, probably, which is
well,
okay.
I must say, I don't think I used the word jerk in the book.
Okay,
I wouldn't have done that.
Well, let's talk, one of the, we talk about John having 92% unique, and of course, for us sword drill scholars back in our elementary days, of course, we knew that the shortest verse in the Bible, Jesus wept. Maybe just say a word about that and the context around that.
Yeah. Well, that's like 11, I think. That's the raising of Lazarus, which is the miracle, oddly enough, that leads to his death in John. I mean, Jesus giving someone life, his friend Lazarus, is what ends up having him. And they decide they're going to kill Lazarus too. I don't know if they actually ever did it. We're not told. But that business of Jesus wept, I think that's another example of him not being understood, because we don't know why he wept. Now, in the synoptics, when Jesus weeps over Jerusalem, we know exactly why he's weeping. He sees, in his prophetic imagination that Jerusalem is going to be destroyed, and there's this, a million people are killed, and there's cannibalism. I mean, it's the worst imaginable thing, that you could ever imagine happening. But when he weeps at Lazarus's death, you really don't know why. John doesn't tell us why. At one point, the people say, oh, see how much he loved him. And given the way John tells his story, I tend to think, well, that can't be the reason why he's crying. The people have got to be wrong, because they're always wrong. So is he crying because of their lack of faith? Is he crying because Mary's crying? Is he crying because he's going to be in the tomb, in a week or so? Is he crying because it's a death-impregnated world and he can't help? Because he knows he's going to raise Lazarus. He told his disciples that, three or four days earlier. So I look at the raising of Lazarus as this wonderful mystery. Here Jesus is weeping, and nobody knows why.
It's that story also, of course, challenges us. We say, why did he wait a couple of days? The Mary and Martha come out and say, it's been 4 days. It's like, where have you been, kind of thing.
Well, we know why he did that. That's kind of a fun, to me, is sort of a fun part of the story. You're talking about the fact that they send a messenger to get Jesus. Not really sure if he's where he is. There are two different villages that have the same name, so we're not sure. I tend to think he's just about 20 miles away. But anyway, that doesn't matter. The messenger comes and says, "Your friend is sick." And Jesus here. This is a perfect example, Neil. Jesus says, "Lazarus is asleep." And what do the disciples say?
He'll get better.
Well, he'll get better. Yeah. And Jesus says, "No." See, they misunderstand. He can't say anything deeply significant without being misunderstood. And so then he says, very, very cruel, very harsh. He says, "He's dead, and I'm glad I wasn't there." It's like, wow, ouch, Jesus, come on, lighten up. I'm glad I wasn't there because it's gonna end up with God being glorified because Jesus is gonna go raise him from the dead. So he actually waits where he is a couple of more days. So by the time he gets there, Lazarus has been in the tomb for 4 days. And the reason there's a little background here that helps in Judaism. I'm not saying this is true, but the belief was that the spirit would stay close to the body for 3 days. But after 3 days, because of decomposition and all the rest, the spirit wouldn't at one point wouldn't recognize the body anymore, and the spirit would leave. And so, maybe up to 3 days you could be raised from the dead, but after 4 days, it's impossible. And all the other people Jesus raises from the dead have just died.
Yeah.
I mean, minutes to an hour or so. The little girl dies when Jesus is on the way to heal her. But no, Lazarus is. Martha's absolutely right. He's stinking. I mean, it's. That's not the climate that you want to go around a dead body in.
Yeah.
And so I think he purposely does that. So it's impossible. When he tells Martha, your brother will rise again, she says, "Well, I know in the resurrection he'll rise again," because nobody with any sense, no one thought he could raise Lazarus from the dead. That was impossible, and that's the point.
Yeah.
He made it. He waited until the point where it was impossible.
Yeah. Michael, say where, as we talk about the disciples not understanding, of course, John chapter 13, he washes his disciples' feet. I mean, that was probably, where they sort of started to get it at that point, perhaps.
Yeah, I think that was a powerful, powerful moment. And I think certainly the other gospel writers know that story. But I honestly don't think they could bring themselves to tell it, because it really is a humiliating thing for Jesus to do. When Peter says, "You ought not to be doing this," he really is right. I mean, that was, here's another piece of background. There's a saying in the Talmud that the rabbi said, "Every task that a slave does for his master will a disciple do for his teacher, but one." He cannot loosen the thong of his sandal. So this mandate went out that the followers of these rabbis, who some of whom were very, very popular and very famous, that's one thing you couldn't do. And so John the Baptist says, I'm not even worthy to loosen the sandal of Jesus, right?
Yeah.
That's John's way of saying, I'm really humble. And he was being humble. But how much more humble is the person who takes off their sandal and washes their feet? So I think they were scandalized by what he did.
As we should be, probably, if we really read the Gospels with imagination, if we really understood what Jesus came, his authority, and what are some of your maybe reflections, having completed this series now, maybe especially just going through John, how are you seeing Jesus differently than maybe you did before?
Well, I think you're right. It's much more dynamic. I call it reading in Sunday school voice. I just sort of read things in Sunday school voice, And when you stop and engage, and you realize, I mean, in John, when Jesus talks about eating his flesh and drinking his blood, the people are horrified when he says that. I mean, remember, he's talking to Jewish people who, you know, have a very, kosher sort of lifestyle, and he couldn't have been more shocking. He couldn't have chose more shocking language than the language he chose. You know, the business with washing their feet. You know, we look at that as, isn't that kind of a sweet, you know, sweet thing that Jesus did? No, the truth is it was a very humiliating, and Peter said what really every one of them should have said. You know, you ought not to be doing this. This is too much. This is over the top. And the thing is, Neil, when I see Jesus now, I understand that that's the sort of person he is. He's over the top. He's always pushing. He's always going beyond what's expected. And I think sometimes the American Jesus, he doesn't surprise anyone. He doesn't fail to meet anyone's expectations because we sort of dumb him down to the point that he really can't. He can't mess up. But I think the Jesus of the gospel, the true biblical Jesus, is always, well, he's the stone that makes men stumble, the Bible says.
Yeah. Michael, do you have a favorite verse from John? I mean, you know, John 3:16 or John 1:12 or what do you think?
That's a good question. I really do think my favorite verse is that passage in 7 after verse 37 where, you know, on the last and greatest day of the feast, Jesus stands up and says, in a loud voice, if a man is thirsty, let him come to me and drink. It's my favorite verse because it changed my life. The backgrounds just made a huge difference in my life. But again, here's a new idea for me that was just since I wrote the book. Earlier in the chapter, you find out that there are, well, the disciples say, you know, there are people waiting there to kill you. There are men in the crowd who have made a vow. Like some of them made a vow to kill Paul. There are people who have made vows to kill Jesus. And the fact that he stands up in that crowd, and very easy in that day, there were assassins that specialized in sneaking up behind people and knifing them in the crowd. They were called sicarii. In a crowd like that, Jesus' courage, I just see him in a new way in terms of being this incredibly courageous person to stand up there and give testimony to the truth when it's going to cost him his life. And I have, as an older person, I have a new appreciation for that kind of courage.
Seeing Jesus in a whole new light through the eyes of informed imagination. That's what you'll experience if you pick up any of Michael's the four Gospels that he's done. Just completed John, the Gospel of Wisdom. It's part four of the Biblical Imagination series. And coming to us from InterVarsity Press, thanks to Michael Card, who's a recording artist and musician and has authored a number of books and 31 albums and much more. And Michael, we always appreciate the opportunity to just talk scripture and faith with you. It's good to connect once again.
Thank you. Thanks for taking the time to talk.
Michael Card, our guest today on Connecting Faith. And if you missed part of today's program and like to hear it again, or maybe even better, pass it on to a friend, you can do so by checking out our podcast. We've got the audio archives posted on our website. You go to myfaithradio.com and then click on the Connecting Faith show page. It's myfaithradio.com. Click on Connecting Faith, and you can enjoy the podcast archives there. And they're all shareable, so pass it on to a friend for this and many of the other great interviews that we've had here in the broadcast. By the way, we mentioned we had a couple of copies of Michael's commentary on John, the Gospel of Wisdom, to give away. And we'll do that via email. So when you go to our website, myfaithradio.com, click on Connecting Faith. There's an email link right there. Just fill in the information, give us your address, contact information, and we'll do a drawing and perhaps pull your name out and send you a copy of Michael's great devotional commentary on the Gospel of John. Well, coming up the rest of the week, Joe Rathmann are filling in for me. I encourage you to listen in for Connecting Faith as we provide daily hope and encouragement, finding ways that we can apply biblical principles to daily life experiences. Connecting Faith to Life every day. Thanks for listening.